The Song of Solomon, chapter 5, and we'll pick up where we left off previously. We're looking at this book as a collection of love songs reflecting the love between a young man and a young lady. Up until now, they have been courting, and it is still the case, although it's going to finish, I believe, with the wedding day. We've already had some pictures of the wedding day, a few dreams. We've had the lady dreaming of her man coming to claim her as his bride. We've had dreams of the great desire which they have for each other, and we've certainly had some very beautiful pictures of the responses which lovers make to each other. However, we have now a dream of a different type. It's a dream of frustration. Great frustration, as the woman wants to be with her man, yet she can't be for some reason. Perhaps she's at home, or perhaps their farms are separated by several miles. Perhaps he's gone away with some sheep for a while, and so she has no way of making contact with him. And her frustration is reflected in a dream. It's a dream I'm sure that we can all identify with, because we all have these dreams of frustration at times. We're trying to get something done, we're under a lot of pressure, and then we dream these most tantalizing dreams where everything seems to be going wrong. We're trying to get a thing finished, and the harder we try, the more we get fouled up by something. Something intervenes. You know the sort of thing I'm talking about? I'm always having these dreams. It's something simple. Let's think I'm going to catch a bus. So I'm running to catch a bus, and just as I go to cross the street, of course, my shoelace breaks. And you bend down to pick up your shoelace and split your trousers or something like that. And as you get mobile again, sure as an old lady is just going to walk out in front of you, and so you have to stop to let her go. The bus is just about to move off, and you're now about to go across the street, and suddenly the light turns red. And no matter how hard you try, you just can't get to the place that you're trying to get to. You know, that sort of frustration type of dream. Well, as you all know, it takes all sorts of forms, that type of dream. And here we find a different form of that very same dream of frustration. Here, the woman has gone to bed, and she's asleep. She puts it very dramatically in verse 2, "I slept, but my heart was awake." Isn't that a magnificent way of describing a dream? Have you ever been like that? You've been to sleep and you've dreamt the most confusing and active types of dreams all night, and you get up in the morning and feel you haven't even been to sleep. Now, you have been asleep, of course, but your heart has been awake, so to speak, and you don't feel as relaxed as you ought to be. Probably are, but you just don't feel that way. Now here she has gone to sleep, but her mind is so full of activity because of her great desire for her lover that she has this dream. And she dreams that her lover comes knocking on the door. It takes her just a while to realize that there's somebody there. Then she gets out of bed and she suddenly realizes that she can't go rushing out answering the door in her night attire. The first reaction she has is that she's just washed her feet and got into bed. Now this is all a dream. She's already been asleep, let us say, for 3 hours, but this is the way it occurs in the dream. She's only just got into bed, and of course, I suppose, dirt floor, that sort of thing, you have to wash your feet, dry them, and then get into bed. Last thing you do. Bit of a chore, I suppose. She's just got nice and comfortable, she's snuggled in under the blankets, and someone knocks at the door. And she thinks, oh bother, I've just washed my feet and I've got to get up and dirty them again. And then, oh, I mustn't go rushing out like this, I better put on my dressing gown. Or perhaps it's her lover, maybe she should give herself a squirt with some spray that she bought down the chemist the other day. And, oh, my hair's in rollers too, I can't go seeing him like this. You know the sort of responses we have, we don't express them in words, they're fleeting impressions that go through a person's mind. And here she's put these down. All of these fleeting impressions going through her mind, finally she gets to the door, but of course it's taken her so long because of all the other things that have intervened that by the time she got there, her lover has gone. Very typical type of dream, isn't it? Let's read it through. Verse 2, "I slept, but my heart was awake. Hark, it's my beloved, he's knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. My head is wet with dew, I've been travelling through the night. My locks are wet with the drops of the night." And then she says to herself, "I've just gone to the trouble of bathing and getting dressed. I've put off my garment, how can I put it on again? I just bathed my feet, how can I soil them again? Meanwhile, my beloved put his hand to the latch. Oh, my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved. My hands dripped with myrrh, I had to put on the perfume first. And I had to put something on my fingers too. Liquid myrrh, and I put them upon the handle of the bolt, and eventually I got round to opening the door to my beloved. But my beloved had turned and gone. She'd delayed too long. And he'd reached the conclusion she wasn't even home, and so he'd gone off disappointed. And now she says, "My soul failed me," when he spoke. "I sought him, but I found him not. I called him, but he gave me no answer. He'd gone. It was too late." And now she went rushing off into the street in her nightwear. Well, you can imagine what the guards of the city thought. What do you think if you're a city watchman, you're out there in the middle of the night, and a woman comes running around, very scantily clad, in her night attire? Well perfumed too, by the way. She'd just gone to great lengths to put a bit of perfume on and make herself attractive. Well, in verse 7, the watchmen of the city found her. She says, "They found me as they went about in the city, and they beat me and they wounded me." They no doubt assumed she was a prostitute or some other young scallywag that needed to be dealt with. "They took away my mantle," those watchmen of the walls. "Oh, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, help me," she says. "If you find my beloved, tell him that I'm sick with love." It wasn't that I didn't love him. "I'm sick with love and, oh, I've missed him again." When she says this to the women of Jerusalem, they reply in verse 9 by saying, "Well, what's your beloved more than anyone else's beloved? What's so special about him, O fairest among women? What is your beloved more than another's beloved that you thus adjure us?" Well, she says, "I'll tell you about my beloved." And then in verse 10, all the way through to verse 16, she describes him. In appearance, in build, in personality, in every way, he is the best. "My beloved is all radiant and ruddy." And so she goes on. His head is this, his eyes are that, his cheeks are this. And she goes on explaining the beauty of her lover. "This is my beloved," in verse 16. "This is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." Whereupon in chapter 6, verse 1, they say, "Well, if he's so good, we'd better meet him." "Where then has your beloved gone, O fairest among women," say the daughters of Jerusalem. "Where has your beloved turned so that we may seek him with you? If he's so good, we'd love to meet him." And then in verse 2, the woman suddenly comes to her senses. Perhaps she wakes. She suddenly remembers she hasn't really lost her man after all. I gather that this is the point at which she wakes up. He hasn't left her. It's all been but a dream. And she's a bit relieved now to find that it was only a dream. She knows where he is. He's down there on the farm, faithful to her as ever. "My beloved has gone down to his garden," that's where he is. "He's there in the bed of spices, he's pasturing his flock in the gardens, he's down there gathering lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He pastures his flock among the lilies. He's faithful to me, I know. I'm faithful to him, and so it will be forever." So much for her first dream. The next section, which starts in chapter 6, verse 4, and goes through to chapter 8, verse 4, indicates something of the strong desires that the lovers have for each other, and at the same time the restraint that they exercise. Now this is where I get my title for this half of the study from. The discipline of love. The restraint. Restrained behaviour. That's probably a good summary of the section. There's no doubt that their desires are very strong. And anybody who's been through courtship knows indeed that the desires of one for the other are very strong. It calls for the utmost self-discipline to restrain oneself from doing all the things one would like to do. Well, here we find this reflected, this tantalizing feeling where each would love to be totally belonging to the other, yet the discipline is necessary. So the man starts off in verse 4 by praising her beauty, and his praise, as usual, seems to go a bit beyond bounds, mainly because he just can't find the words to describe her. "You are beautiful as Tirzah." Tirzah was a city. Fancy describing a woman as being as beautiful as a city. "You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love. You're as comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. Oh, turn away your eyes from me, for they disturb me." He really gets turned on, you see, when he finds her gazing into his eyes. Some funny feelings come into him, and he says, "Oh, just turn away." He feels himself overcome with his love towards her. Then he goes on to describe her hair, once again her teeth, her cheeks, and so it goes on. In verse 8, he contrasts her with the harem women of Jerusalem. Now the king has his agents, and he also has a good pair of eyes in his own head, and he spies out the beautiful women around the country, and he brings them into Jerusalem, puts them into the palace, and they become his concubines, or his queens. Well, says this man, the king has many, many queens, many, many concubines, but none of them, he says, compares with you, my love. There are 60 queens, verse 8, and there are 80 concubines. We know from 1 Kings, of course, that there were actually a lot more than that. But as far as this man's concerned, he settles on 60, which you'll have to admit is a reasonable number of queens for a person to have, and 80 concubines, that's not bad going either. He says there are maidens without number. Oh, he does realize there are a few others unaccounted for. The king has chosen all the most beautiful women for his harem, but, verse 9, my dove, my perfect one, is the only one. As far as I'm concerned, he says, she's the only one. The king with his dozens and dozens and dozens of women, but you, my darling, are my only one. The darling of her mother, flawless to her that bore her. The maidens saw her and called her happy, and the queens and the concubines also, they praised her. In other words, he is saying, or he imagines all this, this again is the extravagant assessment which a man has for his beloved. He says, they must all look with envy at the beauty of this beautiful farm girl. This farm girl that was his beloved. He thinks of all those carefully chosen women there in the king's palace, and he says that they must look with envy upon this one who is his. There again you can see something of the biased assessment which lovers have of each other. And so it ought to be. So it goes on through the rest of the chapter as he rejoices in her beauty. There's an interesting bit at the end where it seems that the women of Jerusalem speak, and they ask the beautiful farm girl here, this Shulamite, verse 13, they ask her for a show. Now the harem women, I guess, put on all sorts of erotic shows at different times. So they say to this woman, return that we may look upon you. They want her to perform something to parade her beauty. If she's as great as this man says, they say, well, come over here and parade yourself. Do an erotic dance. Those sorts of things, these belly dances you see on the movies. It seems they can't have any movie which is in any way connected with anything that happened in the Middle East without somewhere in the movie having a belly dance. That appears to be the sort of thing that's talked about here. And the Shulamite's not going to be in it. She is not up for show. She is not a common dance girl. So in the second half of verse 13 she says, why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance between two armies? She says, I am not there for the vulgar gaze of your eyes. Whereupon the man further extravagantly praises her beauty in chapter 7, and he gets more erotic than ever. As he moves through this song, again he describes her from head to toe with great detail. So it goes on. If you want to meditate upon the details there, well, by all means do. But let's move down to the woman's response. After he makes this rather extravagant assessment of her beauty, she responds in verse 10. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Well, that's fairly obvious when you've read the previous verses. But what she's saying is this, I belong solely to my lover. I am not up for show, I'm not a common dance girl. I'm not going to accept their vulgar eyes gazing upon me. But this rather erotic description of her from her lover, she can take lots of that. It's a different person, you see, who's making the comment. It's a different set of eyes that are prying on her beauty. So she says, I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me, I'm for him and he's for me, and we're not going to share this relationship with anybody else. That's selfishness of a good type. It's the sort of exclusiveness that belongs to this relationship between the sexes, and it ought to be guarded. She then suggests to her lover that they go for a walk in the countryside. Typical Sunday afternoon stroll. Well, not exactly typical, but two lovers just going hand in hand for a stroll along the lanes, through the byways, and enjoying the relaxing atmosphere of the countryside. Come, my beloved, she says in verse 11, and let us go for a walk in the fields, and we'll lodge in the villages. We'll go out early to the vineyards, and we'll see whether the vines have budded. And so it is these two farmer-type people wandering around the farm, looking at all the beautiful things. And she experiences a great frustration at not being able to express her love openly as she might if he were her brother. In some of these societies, there is a taboo about people kissing in public. It's all right if the persons were brother and sister. But in this case, he and she are not married, and so the woman and her lover are not able to express their love as they might like. That's why she says in verse 1 of chapter 8, "I wish you were my brother. Then, if I met you outside, I could kiss you, and nobody would despise me. It would be socially acceptable. I'd lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, into the house of the chamber of her that conceived me." Then verse 3, "Oh, that his left hand were under my head, and that his right hand embraced me." Oh, she just longs again for this embrace of love. "I adjure you," in verse 4, "O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up nor awaken love until it please." "I'm having enough trouble," she says, "controlling my feelings without people like you coming along, urging us on to even more extravagant expressions of love." These expressions of love are going to come in due course. We don't need anybody to rouse us up in the meantime. There's a good reminder there for us, isn't there? No sense feeding our weaknesses. We've got enough trouble controlling some of our passions without having them stirred up by erotic songs or pictures or other temptations which are put in our way. Or, I might add, which sometimes we go out of our way to put ourselves into. Some of the temptations we get into through our own stupidity. We have enough trouble controlling ourselves without making more trouble for ourselves. That's what she's saying. Coming now to our final song, I've entitled this one, "True Love Rewarded." From verse 5 to the end of the book, "True Love Rewarded." I believe now we have the picture of the couple happily married, and now they're coming home to her house. Well, I assume it's her house. This verse 5 is rather difficult, and I think you'll find in different versions of the Bible, those versions such as Good News Bible and New International Version, those versions which point out who is supposed to be speaking in each part, you find there is a little bit of disagreement over verse 5. We're not quite sure whose house it is that they're coming to. Certainly we have a picture of the two lovers walking along the road on the way home. First couple of lines of verse 5. Who is that coming up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? So these two lovers here are walking along the road and they're coming home. But whose home it is, we're not quite sure. Frankly, I think it's the girl's home that they're approaching. And if that's the case, then the man is the one who speaks in verse 5. It appears to me that he reminds the girl that it was here, in the garden of the house where she was born, that he first fell in love with her. "Under the apple tree, I awakened you. There, your mother was in travail with you. There, she who bore you was in travail. Here, this is your home, where you were born." And he said, "It's here that I first fell in love with you when I saw you sitting there under the apple tree." Now, some of the other versions take it the other way around, that it's the lady who speaks here. Well, we'll leave it at that. We're not going to spend too much time. As long as you've got the picture of this couple approaching the home. Certainly, however, from verse 6 through to verse 12, it is the lady who speaks. Magnificent section. The discipline of love. Let us see what it says, and I hope we can learn one or two things from it. "Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm," she says to her husband, I take him to be now. "For love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly scorned." Priceless, isn't it? Priceless section, but love also. Love also is priceless, that's what she's saying. Then in verse 8 and 9 and 10, she recalls the words of her brothers when she was only in her early teens. And her brothers, who were her older brothers, they were very concerned that she should develop character and that she should know how to retain her purity and resist the advances of unworthy youths. So it's a very typical teenage type situation that we have here, where we are well aware of the temptations and the stresses that young people face. Now her older brothers, they've been around too, they know what it's all about, and they're concerned for their younger sister, and they want her to have a bit of moral fibre so that she can resist the advances of the different men who might try to influence her. So while she is just beginning to develop, perhaps in her early teens, perhaps she's now 13 or 14 or something like that, they start to get concerned about how they can protect her as she develops and matures and becomes 15, 16, 17, 18, and obviously attracts the attention of others. So they say in verse 8, we have a little sister. She has no breasts. Now, what shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? We must think now, she's just starting to develop, she's starting to attract the attention of others. What must we do? Well, there are two alternatives. One is if she is a wall, first half of verse 9, and the other is, second half of verse 9, if she is a door. If she is a wall, if she is a door. Now you can see the picture here. If she is a wall, someone who resists, she's going to be steadfast and she's going to resist these unworthy characters that might make advances when they shouldn't or want to do things that they shouldn't. If she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. If she proves to be a strong-charactered person, then they said we will honour her and we will strengthen her. If, however, she tends to be a door, yields rather too easily, leaves herself open, gives in, if she's a door, then they said we'll enclose her with boards of cedar. We'll gather round and protect her so that she maintains her purity in the face of these temptations. Well, says the girl in verse 10, I was a wall. She said, I did resist. I maintained my purity, and now I have preserved myself intact for this my husband. I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers, and then I was in his eyes as one who brings peace. She's contented with him, and he now has great contentment in her. This is true love, she says. And Solomon, with all his women and all the trimmings of the palace, she said he can keep the lot. She likens Solomon's maintenance of his harem to an orchardist's maintenance of his orchard. In maintaining his harem, Solomon was like a man maintaining a vineyard of hired workers. A little bit of a slur there in the expression hired workers, because that's what these women in effect were. There was no real love there. They were a little better than legalized prostitutes. They weren't working for the riffraff around town. They were all there working only for the king. But they were like hired workers. There was that element of commerce about the whole thing. They were bits of merchandise. Solomon in verse 11 had a vineyard at Baal Hamon, and he let out the vineyard to keepers. These are the hired workers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. And so these women, they're all got to come along and satisfy Solomon according to his various moods. Well, she says in verse 12, my vineyard is not for hire. My vineyard, my very own, is for myself. I am not for hire. All Solomon's hired vineyard workers, all his harem women, he can keep them. My vineyard is my very own. It is for myself. And you, O Solomon, you can keep your 1,000. And the keepers of the fruit, 200. The women can keep their wages, and Solomon can keep his women. I am not for hire for anyone. I belong solely to my lover, and he is mine. And that's the great climax. That's the climax of love. And that's what a true relationship between a man and a woman should be when it consummates in marriage. And when the lady expresses those feelings, the man responds in verse 13, and he says, oh, you who dwell in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it, he says. Just speak a few words, he says, so that I and my friends can listen. Here as we celebrate our marriage, and we have a few friends around now to rejoice with us on this happy occasion, he says, say something, just so that we can all sit back and appreciate the beauty of your words. And what are the words that she repeats? The words that she says in verse 14 are an echo of words of former years. She says, make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of spices. Remember that in our opening study, way back there in chapter 2, one of her dreams, when she says, the voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains and bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. And then she finished the dream by saying, until the day breathes and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains. Well, now the gazelle, the young stag, has come. And he is hers and she is his. That must have been the particular expression which was so dear to her that when he said, say something, the very words she says are an echo of the words of former years when she said to her man, "Come and take me." Now he has come and taken me. And I suppose we could conclude by saying they lived happily ever after.